Hey, everybody. This episode is brought to you by our proud title sponsor, NHL Sense Arena, the next generation of off-ice hockey training for players and goalies. Look, we know how much you invest in your children's hockey development, the early mornings, the travel, and let's not forget the expenses of training for hockey camps, private ice time, the general expenses of the season. It's a lot. But wouldn't it be great to bring that on-ice practice experience home that's fun, fits into your schedule, and that's affordable? If you said yes, which I'm sure you did, you've got to check out NHL Sense Arena. It's a top-tier virtual reality training game that brings the on-ice practice experience home so you can practice anytime and anywhere, literally. You can transform any part of your home into a virtual ice rink where you're getting unlimited access to over 100 drills, training plans from top coaches and players, weekly drill challenges, and more that focus on improving hockey sense and physical cognitive skills, starting at just $33 per month. That is a lot cheaper than an hour of ice time. The physical side of hockey gets a lot of attention, but we don't focus enough on the mental side of it. It's something we talk about on this show all the time. NHL Sense Arena provides an immersive solution for players to sharpen those skills when ice time is limited or not affordable and they want to get those extra reps in. So, for our listeners, NHL Sense Arena is offering an exclusive $50 off their annual plan. All you got to do is head over to their website, hockey.senseArena.com. Again, hockey.senseArena.com, and use our code HOCKEYNEVERSTOPS, and you'll level up your off-ice training by using NHL Sense Arena. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for supporting us and NHL Sense Arena. Enjoy this episode of Our Kids Play Hockey. What's up, everybody? It's Lee. We got a great episode today. We have Captain America on today. The captain of Team USA's Paralympic team, Josh Pauls, joins us on this episode. This is a great episode if you want to learn how to deal with adversity, if you need an anchor in your life that's going to help you push through, or really just if you want to know what it takes to play hockey at one of the highest international, Olympic, and world championship levels possible. Josh has an amazing story, and we had a lot of great questions on this episode about his life, how he deals with adversity, and many other things that's going to be of value. But before we start, reminder for the last week this week, this podcast is brought to you by Hockey Wraparound. Check them out on hockeywraparound.com and use the code OKPH for 20% off your entire order. All right. Once again, they have the world's top blade stick protector. They also have the dry stick, which is really amazing. My son uses that to dry his equipment. Just go check it out. It'll be worth the 5 minutes. They're also available on Amazon. But if you want the discount of 20%, OKPH on hockeywraparound.com, hockeywraparound.com, hockeywraparound.com. With that said, enjoy the music and enjoy the show. It's Our Kids Play Hockey. Hello, hockey friends and families around the world, and welcome to another edition of Our Kids Play Hockey. I'm Lee Elias, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friends Christy Casciano-Burns and Mike Benelli, and we are privileged today to be joined by a three-time World Championship gold medalist, a three-time Olympic gold medalist in Pyeongchang, Sochi, and Vancouver, where he was the youngest member of the team at 16 years of age in the Paralympic Games. He is the captain of Team USA. Josh Pauls, welcome to Our Kids Play Hockey.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be joined this morning.
No, it's great to have you here. I said it before when you were on the air before. It is so awesome to have the captain of Team USA here. I don't get to say that too often. It's going to be a great show. I love being able to do that. It makes me feel like a ring announcer. But let's jump right into it, Josh. We know this. You hail from the great state of New Jersey. Tell us about your journey into the game.
I mean, it's nice to have the New York crew with me, so just don't hold me coming from New Jersey against me. But
I'm from Pennsylvania, so you're surrounded, Josh. You got New York and Pennsylvania. You're like our little stepbrother. But we're gonna let it's your time today, so you're the star.
I mean, I'm stuck on the peninsula, I guess, but I guess there's better worse places to be stranded. So, but my hockey journey started really similar to a lot of people's. My parents kind of got me into it, but unlike a lot of hockey players, I was born, and when I popped out, my legs were kind of funky. They were kind of bowed in, so they kind of put some casts on. They took some x-rays, and they realized that I was missing something pretty important. I was missing my tibia bone, which is the bigger bone in your shin. So I wasn't able to walk. My mom said that, you know, when I was a kid, I used to kind of just throw my legs behind me and crawl around. And so at 10 months old, they had to make the decision to have my legs amputated. Ended up wearing prosthetics, started walking at a year old, and then ended up finding hockey in Woodbridge, New Jersey with the Woodbridge Warriors program when I was 10 years old. That's kind of when I started playing hockey. And it was just something that, you know, my family had been big into. My parents are both big Devils fans. I started out as a Rangers fan, and then I jumped across the Hudson River. I'm not going to talk too much about that unless you want to bring it up. But yeah, I mean, it's been a wild journey, and hockey's really given me a lot, but I'm excited to see where else it'll take me.
Well, listen, I'll bring it up. You were born in the early 90s. It was a good time to jump the ship to become a Devils fan. Rangers fans will say we had 94, but the Devils pretty much had the late 90s into the 2000s. So you might have made a good decision there, depending on who you talk to. But fandom is one of the best parts of the show. Now, listen, one thing I want to jump into is, as we said this multiple times, you're the captain of Team USA. And as you know, our audience is a lot of parents, a lot of coaches, and, you know, we're really trying to influence the next generation. So being a captain comes with a lot of responsibility. It comes with a lot of leadership qualities that are needed. Generally, what is it like to be captain of Team USA and to represent our country?
I mean, first of all, it's an honor. I mean, to really be able to wear that C on your jersey and to carry it for as long as I have so far. I mean, it's an unbelievable feeling. And, you know, when I first heard my name being announced, like, just a really special moment, because there are so many other people that kind of contributed to it. The captains that came before me, coaches, you know, Dan Brennan, our general manager, like a lot of people help you along the way. Frankly, it's pretty easy. We have a pretty awesome team that doesn't really require a ton of stuff. Like sometimes I'm making executive decisions on, you know, hey, maybe we can push a bus back or change the schedule around a little bit. But really, it's just making sure that everybody's kind of pulling in the right direction, because, you know, on our national team, really similar to our USA Hockey women's program, where we kind of train individually and then we get together for camps and meet for a couple of days at a time every month. And then we end up accumulating in a world championship or Paralympic games. And so it's a lot of, you know, making sure that, you know, I have to understand that I'm always being evaluated, whether I know it or not. People are always looking up to me, and I want to make sure that I'm giving them something to look up to every chance I get, because you never know when you're being watched. So you have to act as if you're always being evaluated.
It's a phenomenal
point. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've said on the show before that, you know, we've had a whole show about captaincy, and you totally emulate and personify everything that we spoke about, which was that, you know, if you need the C on your jersey, you're probably not ready to be a captain. You know what I mean? And the truth is, like you said, it is an honor to have that letter. You said that you were chosen, right? And again, I think that it speaks to you from a leadership standpoint. You didn't need that to be a captain, but it's an honor at the same time to have it. So again, tell us a little bit about, you know, how you got into sled hockey and the teams you played for leading up to Team USA, because I think that's part of the story that the listening audience would just love to hear.
For sure. I mean, so I first saw my first sled hockey game at 8 years old. A team from South Jersey came up to Bridgewater, New Jersey. I got to watch a game. I got to try a sled, and just was too far. My parents couldn't make the commitment to drive me down. And so a team opened up in Woodbridge, New Jersey, 15, 20 minutes from my house. And so they said, hey, why don't you give it a try? And I was about 10 years old. I wanted to really, really wanted to be a goalie. I'm really glad I didn't and was pushed the other way.
A lot of parents agree with you on that one.
Oh yeah. But the thing is, like, I mean, goalies are still one of my favorite positions to watch. The pads and all the designs they have, I guess I'm just a creative kind of guy like that. But I started playing for the Woodbridge Warriors team. We ended up being taken over by the New York Rangers sled hockey program, so we represented the Rangers there. And then I started playing with their adult team. And so I was kind of bouncing back and forth between New Jersey and New York, playing games and playing with an adult team at, you know, 13, 14 years old. And I made the junior national team, I think, in my eighth grade year. And I remember going up to the World Championships in 2008 as part of this development team, the feeder program for the national team, watching the World Championship, watching, you know, our U.S. team play against Canada, play against Norway. And, you know, they ended up winning a bronze medal. I remember Greg Shaw, who ended up being my line mate for a number of years, I was sitting outside our locker room after watching us play, and he was like, hey, you're a pretty good skater, keep it up. And I was like, wow, like, I'm getting recognized. There could be a year that I'm one day part of these guys. And I didn't realize the very next year I'd be on the team.
That must have been an experience at 16 years older. Was this 15 or 16? You were younger, right?
Yeah, I was 15 my first year.
Wow. I mean,
and how intimidating was that to be so young?
It was.
Yeah. How did you deal with that? I mean, what was it that made you strong and confident to get out there? And advice for other kids who may find themselves in that situation.
Sure. I mean, I know there are a lot of kids that might end up playing up a level. It was a little bit different going, you know, being 15 and playing with guys that are, you know, 30, 35, 40 years old. I know, like, it really helped having older guys that, you know, brought me in and made me feel comfortable. I mean, if you ask our equipment manager the first couple of years, he'd probably tell you I said maybe 5 words total over my first year and a half. So I was a pretty quiet kid. I know it's probably hard to imagine that now. But as far as that, like, it was a lot of people that kind of brought you in. I know Taylor Lipsett, he's a big ranking member of USA Hockey, works a lot with the disabled section. And man, he really helped me feel comfortable and he really helped guide me around. And so I think having those mentors, whether or not they have, you know, letters on their jersey or whether they're just respected members of the team, you gotta just try to find those guys. But I think it's even more important for those guys to find the younger ones, because a lot of times it can be hard to ask questions. We were just at our first camp this year, and we had one of our younger guys, Malik. He kind of came up to me. He was like, "Hey, I got a question. Like, can I get some skate blades? Mine are kind of like beat up." And I'm like, "You know, to be honest, I've never needed skate blades before, but let's go find out and figure it out." So I know it can sometimes be hard to ask those questions. So I think it really starts with the top to say, to trickle it down and say, "Hey, like, we got to take these guys under our wing and make sure they know they have everything they need to be successful."
Right. And, you know, it's a good part of leadership lessons here for the people listening, is that it doesn't even matter the age. Like I said, you know, whether it's an 18U team or down, if you're the leader, if you're an older, you know, player on the team, or your son or a daughter is an older player on the team, these are good lessons to teach them. Like, look, you have to bring in these younger kids and make sure that they feel like they're part of the team. You know, I remember being the youngest moving up levels, you know, and it's intimidating, as you said. And if you're a great team, like, and again, it's going to be competitive. Don't get me wrong. That's one of the gifts, I guess, at the end of the day. You probably realize that more as you get older. But the idea is that you have to escort the younger players to be part of the team and incorporate them into that team bond. Now, building on that, again, I want to stay on this being a really young player for a minute, because I think there's a lot of advice we could give there. Now, you've been dealing with adversity since literally the moment you were born. All right. Can you tell us or tell the audience, I should say, you know, how that adversity, and I'm not just talking about your legs, right, being the youngest on the team and finding ways to play when there's not many ways to play. How did you overcome that? What are maybe some of the tips you can tell the audience of how to kind of have that fortitude and perseverance in the face of adversity?
Yeah, to be honest, I think adversity has made me who I am. And I think it's something that most people look at it as a negative, but you really need to look at it as a positive, because it's a way that's going to get you out of your comfort zone. It's going to push you to new heights. And so, you know, it can be really tough being a younger guy on a team, or even just a new player on a team. It's like, you know, switching schools when you're a kid. You don't know anybody. You're still trying to find your way. And so it's tough, but you just got to make sure that you love the process. Like, I'm big on goal setting. And so I had smaller goals. Hey, my first smaller goal was to make sure I could shoot a puck and not have it wobble like a wounded duck. I know my, the backup goalie, Mike Blayback, used to tell me, he's like, "Yeah, you got to get your sled pointed in the right direction, because right now you're tossing floaters at me and I'm catching them. I can't even see," like, making fun of himself and chirping me at the same time. But I knew he was trying to find way, like, he was still giving me tips on how I could actually get better and give him a better shot. And so it's setting short-term goals, but also setting long-term goals. But at the same time, you have to love the process. You can't be in love with the end result. The end result is going to happen as long as you love the process. Right. So while I may not have been at the top level, I was, to be honest, in my first year in the 08-09 season, I was a fourth line player and a three line team. That's just kind of how it ended up shaking out. And so for me, it was finding ways to get better and to stay in the lineup. I know my first 2 years, I don't know, probably actually my first 5 years on the national team, every game I'd say, "Hey, this is going to be the game where I really break out. This is going to be the one time that this is how I'm going to cement myself on this team for the future." It didn't happen for the first 5 or 6 years, but I finally got to a point where I said, "Hey, I'm here. Like, this is where I'm at, and I'm only going to get better." And it just took a lot of positive self-talk, because I think a lot of times people can be negative to themselves. And so I know, like, journaling is a good practice, but you really just got to make sure that you're talking to yourself like you want to talk to your best friend. If you're not letting your friends talk negative about, like, to you directly to your face, then you shouldn't do that to yourself. You got to have that positive self-talk. You got to pump yourself up. And you know what? It's important when you're not feeling able to pump yourself up, it's important to have a support system around you for people that are going to bring you up with you.
Yeah, that support system is crucial. So as you know, look at kids who, you know, you see yourself in these kids, what do you tell them, especially when they're scared. You know, it's something new, it's challenging. What do you say to them to encourage them to go ahead and just give it a try?
So I actually stole this from Connor Carrick's podcast. I know his is one I really listen to a lot, and I'd recommend for any young hockey players. But he talks about it all the time. He's bounced up between the NHL and AHL, and he said, you know, no one can tell you belong in the NHL. You have to believe it first before anybody else is going to believe it. And so for me, you need to know that you belong at whatever level you're at. I don't care if it's squirts, mites, youth, U18, if it's juniors. If you don't believe that you can make that team, if you can contribute, you're never going to contribute on it, right? No one can tell you, no one can give you that confidence. You need to have it yourself.
You know, one of the things we talk about on the show is present moment awareness and, you know, focusing on what you can control. And, you know, sometimes on some shows, we talk about those voices in your head, that internal dialogue and, you know, how they can motivate you to do amazing things or keep you from doing amazing things. And it's so important to realize that those voices really aren't you, right? They're preconditioned thinking, the things that were put in your head. You know, one of the things, Josh, you talked about that I wanted to bring up again is just from a team environment and a belief environment. You know, I remember, you know, we've all been through tough times here as a world here for the last 2 years. And there's been a lot of fear. And it's funny because I'm really proud of the team that I work with here and teams that I coach. And I always tell my teams, do you believe together that we can face adversity and conquer it no matter what it is? And I, you know, they say yes. And I say to them, then you got to believe in that. Right. Come what may, you got to believe in that. And I think sometimes, especially, you know, this is a hockey thing, but it goes beyond hockey. We don't live in the moment with that enough. Yeah. Yes. We're going to have bad games. We're going to have bad seasons. Potentially, you know, we're going to have bad breaks, but do you believe in the team enough that we can conquer those things? And what made me think of that, man, was what you said about 5 years. You waited 5 years. You told yourself, this is going to be my breakout game. Now that's a little more of a personal individual thing, but I love that. Because the belief was there. You had the internal dialogue, you had the belief, and probably the belief in your team that I will get there and it will happen. And you made it happen, right? Our producer, Caitlin, is always saying thoughts become things. I actually really love that she says that, to quote her. You quoted a podcast, I'll quote our producer. You know, thoughts become things. And, you know, the truth is this, and I want to get your take on this, all right? If you are willing to put in the time and the effort, right, good things will happen. Right. I'm not saying you're going to get to the end goal that you want all the time, but good things will happen if you put in the time and effort. And you'll be surprised. This is really to the kids listening. You'll be surprised sometimes the outcomes, because the truth is this: while we're all aspiring to play hockey, or most kids aspire to play in the NHL, the truth is this, you should aspire to that, but also know, parents, coaches, that the lessons you're learning along the way are crucial to being a good citizen, a good person, a good teammate, a good person in society, right? Again, I just spewed a lot there, but, you know, as the leader, as a teammate, as someone who's been through that journey, I just wanted to get your thoughts on that process as a whole.
I mean, that's exactly it. It's a process. There's no quick fix. There's no, oh, if I do this one thing, it's going to help me excel at everything right now, right? There's no, anybody that tells you, oh, this is the new fad diet, it's going to help you lose all this and do all this and all the different things. Like, there, consistency is the one thing that I've found that is going to make you 10 times better than where you were, right? If you can consistently do something day in and day out, you will see those results. And it's like I said earlier, you got to be in love with the process, not the end result, because the end result is going to be a byproduct of the process.
Right.
And so you have to make sure you're day in, day out, you're doing the things that are going to contribute positively towards what you're doing. Now, I'm not saying you have to be on the ice or in the gym every single day, because, you know, we can do active recovery things. There's good days to take extra rest, take a nap, get some more recovery in. So it's not necessarily just go, but it's working about it in a smart way. And it's understanding, like you said, that not everyone's going to make the NHL. It's 0.01%. I don't want to discourage anybody from getting there, but you have to realize that, you know, hockey and, you know, sports in general are going, like you said, are going to teach a lot of lessons and going to help players be contributing members to society. But it's understanding that it's a game that can be with you for the rest of your life if you want it to be.
Totally.
And it's up to us to make sure that it's a game worth being.
You know, you're bringing up something, a great quote. Elon Musk, who is a business person I kind of look up to, I guess, he said this great quote. He goes, I want you to think of your 10-year goal and try and accomplish it in 6 months. And then he follows that up with, you're probably going to fail, but you'll be a lot further ahead than you would be if you didn't look at it that way. And you know, it's that lack of fear of failure that he's talking about, of you have to try for it. So to your point about the 0.01 or whatever, 0.001% of people making the NHL, right? It's the pursuit of the dream that is actually the value, right? Because it makes you understand, hey, I can pursue something. I'm not afraid to fail. And if I don't get what I want, I'll have learned something along the way. We don't tell kids that enough, all right? And again, parents, yeah, we've said this on the show 100 times, Josh, just so you know, is you do not have to support their dream, but you have to support their right to have a dream, right? There's a big difference between those two things. Don't stifle a kid's ability to dream. That's one of the things that honestly is unique about our country and some other countries in the world, but that's what how greatness happens. So speaking of consistency, Josh, I was told by our producer, you have a very unique pregame ritual. I was told to ask about it, and I was told that you would tell us.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately it is now a former pregame ritual. just because, but I will tell you, I did use this pretty much most of my first 10, 11 years on the national team. So, my first year I made it, and we kind of brought it in after a team warm up, and the trainer put his hand on my head and he goes, "Oh, it feels kind of like a potato." And, so we had a gift exchange around the holidays, my second year, and I got a Mr. Potato Head figure. And so I was like, well, what am I going to do with this? I'm not just going to throw it away. So I ended up keeping it in my hockey bag, and I started turning the Mr. Potato Head and facing him towards the opponent's locker room to kind of stare him down, get it really intimidating, like just from my locker room. It's not like they saw it or who's going to be intimidated by potato, right? So that was kind of my thing. Now, unfortunately, Mr. Potato Head took some beatings, just getting thrown around in a hockey bag. It will do that to you. He ended up losing his arm, so I thought we complimented each other pretty well. I'm missing my legs. He's missing his arms. So we worked out, but then I had to just retire him. I do a lot more like visualization, and I guess I consider a little more serious stuff, but to be honest, like the one thing I like to tell everyone, whether they're young or old or first starting out, the best pregame warm-up is going to be one that you can do every day and do all the time, but also one that's going to get you ready. Like whether it's something that is traditionally thought is going to help you get you ready, or if something else, like, everyone's unique and everyone's individual. So it's about finding what works for you.
Absolutely. And I hope you know you've just opened up, your whole team is going to listen to this, and everyone's now going to get you a new Mr. Potato Head or Mrs. Potato Head. We can't delineate between the two anymore. So for those of you listening to the podcast, I want you to know Mike Benelli is here. He is here. He is, as always, crouched and ready for his moment to join. And Mike, I have to ask you, we like to have fun here, Josh, and go around. My pregame ritual growing up was I listened to Enter Sandman by Metallica before every single event, practice, game. It didn't matter. That's what got me going, dating myself a little bit. And I still tend to do that from time to time. It's an awesome song. It might be 30 years old. That's not the point. But Mike, I'm going to ask you, did you have a pregame ritual? And if you don't have an answer, at least just tell me the craziest one that's G-rated, because I've seen some that I can't talk about on here. But Mike, tell me, what was your pregame ritual when you played?
Yeah, I don't think I had one. I think I just had I was a kind of an equipment geek, right? So I really liked to just, I would retape my stick, you know, the butt end, the blade, everything. It would just be, you know, a brand new slate every single time. I think I even did it for most practices. I don't know how my parents afforded all that tape, but, you know, it's just, you know, for me, it was all about to Josh's point, it was all about finding the process of getting ready. Like,
right.
The routine. I was never a big guy that like loved everyone. I still am not, even as a coach, thinking that everybody in the locker room has to listen to the same music and with the same speaker. And I don't know, it's just hard. I understand the camaraderie of it and the team part of it. But to Josh's point, sometimes you just need to, I mean, goalies always get that. They always get that leisure, right? That they're able to go out in the hall and do a whole different warm-up because they're the goalie. Well, you know, however you prepare for your game or for your match or for practice or your visualization techniques, you just have to do that by yourself. And that has to be something that, you know, is true to you. So I think, you know, for me, again, it wasn't, I never had superstitions. I never had to tape my shin guards the same way every time. I think it's just a matter of, you know, being a little, trying to be serious in the locker room and kind of refocusing and thinking about the task at hand and at every level, right? You just plenty of time to have fun after the horn goes off. So I think it's you know, whatever it takes to, for you to get there ready. I'm sure, Lee, I'm sure you, I guarantee you had some kind of superstitions. You had to have. So,
well, I want to first thank you, Mike, for that incredibly boring and standard answer.
I'll take it.
No, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do?
Listen,
he's being honest.
He is being honest. Oh, come on. You guys are jumping on me now. Listen, no, listen, routine is important. And I've known many players that have, you know, very precise with their equipment. Like Sidney Crosby's always saying, I have my routine, and all of his trainers always saying he's got superstitions. He just doesn't say anything about them. But no, yeah, look, mine was always musically based. I never personally cared about like what side my skate went on first or anything like that. In fact, I don't even know what I do. I probably do it by routine, but I don't know. But yeah, no, I used to listen to music. I used to kind of get myself to a certain point. I knew a goalie one time, Josh, you'll find this funny, that this is the weirdest one I've ever seen said, but he would spit on his blocker pad after every save. And it was really disgusting. I'm not going to lie to you, but like, so like, you know, if you got five shots in a sequence, as soon as the puck was out of the zone, you could look at him, he'd spit on his blocker five times. The funny thing is that he wasn't that great. So I don't know why. I mean, honestly, he wasn't that amazing. So I don't know why.
A lot of spitting.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. Like, I'm not sure it mattered, but he did that. So, Christy, I want to give you a chance too. I mean, I don't know if you have a superstition before you go on the air, or if you can't, let's default to your kids. Did they have any superstitions or sequences?
Oh, I'm sure they did. I think Sophia had a little ritual with her friends. They would do a certain kind of, you know, made up handshake or whatever. And I'm sure Joey did with his buddies. As far as going on the air, a little ritual, I do say a little prayer. I really do before I go on the air, just to help me be my best and to, you know, do my best. That I know I'm kind of an old fashioned Catholic girl. What can I do?
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. We talked before on this show too about how important faith is, whether it's religious based or not. Faith is very important. Yeah. All right. That's been your friendly superstition intermission. We're going to go back to Josh now. Josh, thanks for sitting through that. Josh, you talked a little bit before about, you know, the game can take you places, right, beyond just being on the ice. So I know you studied sports management in Lindenwood. I've read that you want to coach one day at the international level. How did school help you with that? How important is it to you to have goals beyond the game? And how do you think, you know, kids should approach that and parents should approach that? Because like I said, when you're playing, there's really one focus, right? And we always tell parents, you know, tell your kids to have a backup plan. You know, it's not a backup plan to the parent, but have a backup plan when you're playing. So tell us a little bit about your schooling and your aspirations for afterwards and how those two correlate.
Sure. I mean, so just kind of before I get into the meat of that, I think one thing that I think my parents always did growing up was understanding, for me specifically, the NHL was never a goal. Professional hockey was just not something that is attainable for me as a player. And so they really made sure that they were the ones that were saying, hey, make sure you have a good schooling, or make sure you know what you want to do, or find something that you want to do. Because it's so hard to choose when you're 18 years old or even younger, figuring out what you want to do. I have a degree in sport management from Lindenwood University. I also have my MBA from Keller School, Graduate School of Management. I'm currently using neither of those as a motivational speaker. I mean, I guess a little bit of my MBA, but that's the thing. Like, you never really know where it's going to take you. And so, you know, I've coached a little bit. I think I'm a level 4 coach with USA Hockey. I coach our local team here in St. Louis as well. So I'm actively coaching there, and I'm sure there's going to be a way that I'll get involved on the sled side once I'm done playing. Able body's fun. It's more, it's a little bit more challenging though for me, but I think it's been kind of a fun challenge when I have been able to coach, just trying to translate sled to stand up and stand up to sled and kind of how all those different things work together. But, you know, my parents were never ones that pushed me to go do anything in hockey. I know my dad sat me down even after I made the national team and said, Josh, if you want me to get you extra ice and want me to find a rink that you can skate at, I'll do it. But I need you to tell me you want to do it. I'm not going to force you to go skate any more than you want to. And so I said, okay, well, yeah, I want to skate 2-3 times a week if I can. Like, I want to do it. And, you know, my parents both really made sure that I had a solid foundation, because I mean, hockey still doesn't pay the bills totally for me. I'd love to say it did, but it's something that, you know, we've gotten to the point of great equality for Olympians and Paralympians. And it's something that I'm really excited that we're working towards. But motivational speaking is my job, really. And so going around and being able to talk with people and under and help them unlock their potential is something that I really love to do. And it's something that, you know, I get to see the light bulb go off. So like, as coaches, I'm sure you get that when a player finally figures it out and they finally get it together, and you're like, oh yeah, like I've been telling you this for like, you know, 6 months before, and now you're finally putting it together. But I think one thing that, you know, parents, coaches, players need to understand is the average person needs to hear a piece of information 10 times before they actually comprehend it. And so I'm a visual learner, but if I hear it a couple times, usually it's kind of implanted. So you can't get too frustrated just trying to, you know, figure it out the very first time. Not everyone's built like that. So it's finding ways to make sure that you're always prepared and you have an idea of what you want to do, because you can always find you can find your passion and then you can find a job now with it. Because with the technology available nowadays, a traditional 9-to-5 job, it shouldn't just be the goal anymore. There are so many other ways to go about it if you're creative enough and if you can find those opportunities.
I think that's great advice. And I think the key here is this, because, you know, look, the conversation with schooling now, especially with college, is starting to change a little bit, right? I still think college is very important, but I always say if you kind of know what you want to do. So I think the key, especially for parents, is not about, hey, you got to go to college. All right. I don't think that's the right message so much anymore. I think the right message is you have to find something you're passionate about and pursue it. And if hockey is that thing, what else can you do in the game, or what else can the game bring you to do? I went to college. My undergraduate was in broadcasting because I wanted to be involved in sports. And my master's degree was in sports management, right? It was all tailored so I could do something in the game, right? Because I knew hockey was my passion. And as I got older, it's funny how your passion can expand to other things. If you have children, it becomes that, hopefully, you know, so forth and so on. But I think that's really great advice that you're saying is, you know, look, know what your passions are and know that you can apply the work ethic to anything you're passionate about. And then also last thing I wanted to just comment on that is it's so important, parents, that, you know, it's not fair to tell an 18-year-old they need to know what they want to do. All right. If an 18-year-old knows what they want to do, and I mean, really knows it, that's kind of a gift in itself. It does happen. Right. But you know, it's so much pressure. Know what you got to do, do a major and figure it out. Why? College is your chance to not do that. College is your chance to try things. If you go into a major and you hate it, change it. Don't stay in it. So I think there's unneeded pressure there from a lot of parents. But I love your advice, Josh, which is, look, find your passion and pursue it. Doesn't matter really what it is. That's what you want to do, right? You don't want to do something you hate. So,
and Lita, to really reinforce that one point, it's the difference between a guy like Connor McDavid. There are some generational people that are going to make the NHL at 18 years old, right? There are some 18-year-olds that know exactly what they want to do right away, but they aren't the rule. They're the exception to the rule. And I think we need to do a better job as a society of understanding that.
Totally. I totally agree with that. And I think that plays even to the larger conversation surrounding mental fitness and mental health, which is changing slowly, but we're still nowhere near where we need to be about this kind of grind and die mentality of, and don't talk about where you're going, right? It's, look, we should be able to have those conversations. You should pursue what you love. You should not feel that pressure. So great. Christy, sorry, did you have something you want to say? I saw you looking up.
I love what you do. Oh. You'll never work a day in your life.
True. Christy's always smiling, friends. She's always, every time I see her, she's smiling. And Mike is too, especially when I say hi to him. There he is, Mike. He's still here. So
it's Pick on Mike podcast day.
Yeah, no, go ahead, Christy.
Oh, I just was wondering if we could just kind of talk about favorite moments on the ice. Yeah. What were some of those magical moments, if you could relive them for us?
Oh, man. Well, there have been a couple. The one important distinction I did want to note, Lee, I think you introduced me as a 3-time world champion. I think we're 4 now.
Hey, listen, I love that you corrected me on that. Yeah.
You know what? We might be up to 5. Hold on. 09, 12, 15, 19, 21. We're up to 5 now. Wow.
Listen, I'll take it. I love that you're correcting me with that. The more, the merrier.
But also, there is a big difference between the Olympics and Paralympics. And so for me, I'm a Paralympic athlete, and I know a lot of people like to say, Hey, I don't want, like, my trainer tells me all the time, hey, I talk about you as an Olympian, because I don't want people to have that connotation of, oh, you're a Paralympian. I don't want them to think less of you before I even get to who you are. And I understand that type of thinking, but at the same time, we just need to change that connotation around Paralympics.
Right.
We don't need to adjust people's perspectives. We need to adjust people's perspectives. We don't need to adjust the word. So for me, I mean, there have been a lot of moments on the ice. I think 2010, just being in the opening ceremony, I think was really awesome, just because I had been cut the year before, right at that tryout in the summer, just to head into that Paralympic year. And so just being on the ice and being a part of a team that we ended up winning all five games, we shut everybody out. We didn't allow a single goal. I think we allowed 30 shots total in five games. So that's an unbelievable moment. But I think the number one moment all time was in the 2018 gold medal game, when Declan Farmer, the Canadians were up 1-0. They took the puck from their end, ended up skating past our guys on our empty net because we pulled the goalie. We were down 1-0 with about a minute left. Guy shoots it. They hit the post on the empty net. And we come back, and with 37 seconds left, we scored to tie the game. And I remember being behind the Canadian net. As a defenseman, I don't recommend you go behind the other team's net if we're just hanging out during normal operations of a game. But, you know, last 40 seconds, you're doing anything to do it. But I remember looking through the net, seeing the goalie kind of down and out, and seeing Declan Farmer, the best player in the world in sled hockey, with a puck on his stick. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we're about to score. And I saw him shoot it in. We ended up scoring. He ended up scoring the game winner in overtime. And that came shortly, a couple months after, I guess it was just about a year after Coach Sauer, who was our coach for, I don't know, since 2012 to 2017. He passed away from cancer during the season the year before. And so to be able to sing the national anthem and to be able to hold the shield we had with the JS initials on there, it was a really special moment to be able to win that for him, and to be able to win it for, and just overcome that adversity. I know you guys are big talking on adversity and overcoming it. I mean, it's probably the most adversity I've ever been through in a hockey game, and we sure pulled it out.
You know, Josh, again, you're bringing up great points. One of them is that moments are awesome, but it's the whole experience, right? And you kind of described that in your answer that, like, yeah, there was this great goal and there was this great comeback, but what it represented as a whole was really, that was the moment for you, right? Like the goal was a piece of it, or being behind the opposing team's net as a defenseman was a piece of it. But yeah, it really is. It's the culmination of everything to that moment, right? Because it, like, look, moments are awesome. Like those big moments are awesome, but it's what it represents really that creates it and makes it the moment, right? The whole thing.
Oh yeah. I mean, I feel bad that I'm going to say this again, because I think I've said it, you know, five times already, but it really is about the process and not the end goal, right? It's right. About all the work that took to get there. And, you know, the stupid things of, you know, hiding a guy's water bottle when we were training together in Chicago, getting him really, really mad. And then, you know, we're in Pyeongchang and, you know, we're winning a gold medal together, singing the national anthem as the flags being raised. Like, it's those little moments that, you know, I'm going to remember forever. And just, it's the best part, I think, about playing a sport or playing any team sport, really.
Well, and Josh, just to quote you, sir, you did say we have to say things 10 times before people really take them in. So we're halfway there with that process thing. No, listen, I think it's worth repeating, right? Part of that. And again, we don't say it enough to our groups. Mike, did you have something, buddy?
Yes. So I want to, so Josh, I do a lot of work with like Ron down in Florida and Chuck Gridley up in New York. And, you know, obviously, you know, sled hockey is a huge part of their lives. And obviously Danny Brennan, and, you know, hearing his passion, but, you know, and you talk about the process and the journey. And one of the biggest aspects that I'm involved in is, you know, growing the game and trying to find more opportunities. So, you know, I've worked with, you know, in the last 2 years, you know, working with the sled hockey programs up here, working with blind hockey organization, you know, working with American Special Hockey, things like that outside of the traditional hockey world. And I think one of the things I find that I see as an organizer is the, you know, parents that don't think their disabled child could do this. So could you tell us, you know, from your parents' perspective and your growth as a young athlete, you know, what were some of the things that your parents found in the sport of ice hockey and sled hockey specifically that said, oh yeah, we're going to throw, well, let's throw Josh out there on this sled of blades and have him get knocked around by a puck at, you know, eye level for the rest of his life. I mean, what would you say to parents of disabled athletes or children that want to get into sports and feel it might not be great for them?
I mean, I think you got to at least let them try it, to be honest. Like, you don't know what they're capable of until you see it, right? And so I do think that there is an issue within the disabled community of parents, and I don't think it's the parents' fault. I think it's parents wanting the best for their kids and wanting to make sure that they have the best chance to succeed. But I really do think you find in the disabled community parents that just don't want their kids to fail and don't want to even give them a chance. And I'm going to bring up, it was kind of a hockey camp I participated in. We ended up doing something up in the Boundary Waters up in Minnesota, up near Canada. And so it was a hockey camp, but it had a lot of different aspects to it. You know, these kids took a canoe from Minnesota up through some water up into basically Canada, some really awesome natural scenery. But one of the requirements was the kids had to all get into a canoe and get out and flip a canoe without help. Because when they're out on the water in a canoe, your parents aren't going to be around to help you. There's nobody else that's going to be around to help you. You're going to just have to figure it out. And, you know, during the camp, obviously, we have pontoon boats going with people just in case something happens. But the reality is we got to make these kids, we got to let them fail. And we got to let them figure it out. And I think that was the best thing that my parents did for me was they allowed me to problem solve. I've always been a problem solver because you just got to figure it out. Like as a kid, my mom said when I still had legs and they really weren't useful, I just kind of threw them behind me and started crawling around and just trying to get around as the best way I could. But yeah, my parents kind of never let me have an excuse. And I think that really helped. You know, I'd say, you know, they'd say, hey, go take out the trash. And I'd say, oh, well, sorry, I don't have my legs on. They'd be like, all right, well, get your legs on and go take out the trash. Like, I'm not going to ask three times. And so I think, you know, they helped set me up for success. And I don't want to ever say they gave me like a tough love because, you know, my parents really cared about me. And I knew that. But I knew everything was in my best interest. So the extra work they were having me do was going to positively contribute somehow. And I think that's the toughest part is understanding that these kids, one, need to learn how to fail because they're going to fail. Because if you set a kid up for so much success and they don't fail till they're 20-something, they're not going to be able to handle that adversity very well. And so setting our kids up for success is letting them fail, letting them fall and get back up. I think it's the quintessential thing. We see kids only start crying when they see the reaction from their parents, right? So we want to make sure that we're obviously just treating everybody like a person. Everyone needs to learn how to fail and overcome adversity. I think we need to just make sure we take the disability out of it. But that's a great question because it's something we see so much throughout the disabled community.
It's a great answer too. You know, look, as a parent, I could say this too. And this is like that unspoken conversation. Like when our kids hurt, we hurt, right? That's the truth of being a parent. When your kids hurt, you hurt. And I think one of the hardest parts of being a parent is knowing your kid is going to fail or has to fail at something to learn, right? And this usually culminates itself, parents, in the, and Mike and Christy and I have talked about this many times of the, look, I told them seven times and they just won't listen to me. You know, and it's like, you know, this is what I do, son. This is what I do. I know what I'm talking about, or my daughter. And the truth is they're going to have to figure it out on their own. And we don't want our kids to hurt, but sometimes you have to let them go through it on their own. It's like, I think that's one of the hardest parts of being a parent. So I think that what your parents did of like, no, you figure it out. I think we need to do that more. You know, one of the things I tell my kid, you know, and I ask my kids, you know, what did you fail at today? Like, I want to know, I want to kind of normalize that kind of conversation in my house. But I think the other important thing is I tell my kid before he plays every game, and I don't care if people roll their eyes at this. I say, I don't care what happens out there today. I'm going to love you the same no matter what at the end of it, right? Like I want to win the game, but I don't really, I'm not basing my love for you off whether or not you win a game or have a good game or score a goal. All right. I don't think that softens my kid. He's going to compete. All right. But I don't want him to think that that's the be all end all. And I think those, Josh, to your point, I think those two things can exist at once. You got the tough love, but it's still love. You know, your parents cared about you, right? You know what I mean? Like we need to do that more as coaches and parents and society really.
100%. I mean, it's just like anything. If, you know, if I know you have my best interest in mind and I know you're pulling for me, and you're going to help me. Well, I'm going to compete that much more for you. And right. I think that works for coaches and players, but it also works for parents and kids. If I know you have my best interest in mind, well, all right, maybe I'll start listening earlier because I think to your point, like you got to be ready for information to actually receive it. You know, totally. The amount of times my mom's given me advice and I 5-10 years later, I'm like, oh, that's what she meant. Oh yeah, I guess I probably should have listened to her way long ago. But you know, I think the biggest thing to understand is you don't know what you don't know until you know it.
Right. Well, there's a great saying that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Right. And I'll tell you right now, that thought process as a parent starts right from the minute your kid is born. You start realizing, oh, that's what my parents meant. Oh, that's why they do this. Oh, that's why they wanted me out of the house when I was 18. You know, there's lots of those things that happen. So just turn it a little bit here. We recently interviewed the GM of USA Hockey, Dan Brennan, who spoke very highly of you in the program. Sorry, of the USA Head Sled Hockey. And one of the things he spoke about was that sled hockey is really not just limited to people with physical limitations or this disabled, right? Can you tell us more about the program and really how it can be competitive for anyone, right? Obviously for disabled, but also able-bodied people. And we know it's an amazing event anytime you can get able hockey players to play sled hockey, because they don't realize really A, how difficult it is, how competitive it is, and the level at which you play too, Josh. I don't want to downplay that. You know, you're an Olympian, right? You are an Olympic level athlete in this sport. And just like any other Olympic level sport, you compete at that level. So let's talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah. So just touching on the able-bodied disabled. I mean, so USA Hockey in non-international competitions, we allow able-bodied players in different programs. And I think it's one, it was really awesome. I had my sister play with me a couple times in a couple games. So it gives people a different perspective. But I think the one thing to know is hockey still hockey, right? I think when an able-bodied player gets in a sled, their hands are there. They can figure out shooting pretty quickly. It's the whole moving and actually having to skate with your arms instead of your legs is the tough part. And so I think it's awesome to see people come in. I mean, we have a player, Kat Steele. She's on our St. Louis team. She was just a friend of one of our guys that ended up playing. And he was like, hey, why don't you come out, try it? And now she's been a part of a team since I've been out there since 2011. So I think it's just a way to involve more people in the game. I mean, I don't think she'd ever would have played stand-up hockey on her own. And so to have her come over and play sled, I think was really cool. And just a good way that to show that, you know, it's not just for disabled people. Obviously, it was created with that mind, and Paralympic athletes have to have some sort of physical disability. But it's a great way to involve more people in the game and also just, you know, connect with other people that you might not normally. And so I guess getting onto the topic of playing at the elite level, I mean, the game's so fast. I mean, I realized that at our first camp this week. The speed is just so much quicker and it's always getting faster. And, you know, I think when I first started, we started going with players that, you know, would take their right stick and they'd cross it over their left side of their body to handle the puck, where now guys are pretty equally proficient with both hands. So that opens up a whole new can of worms for goalies having to adjust to someone that can shoot from either left side or completely change the angle with, you know, 2-3 feet change and then getting a better shot. So, I mean, the game's always progressing. It's getting faster and more competitive. I mean, the hits are harder. The Canadians are always playing really well and playing hard physical hockey. So it's just, those are the types of games that you just love to play. And I think, you know, the Paralympics are going to be a real challenge this year.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you've got some big doings coming up. You're back on.
Yeah, we are. After a long pause, we kind of got back for a world championship to kind of have the first five slots set for the Paralympics. And now we're back at it. So we had tryouts in July. We had another tryout here, and we're playing Canada and St. Louis at the Centene Community Ice Center where the Blues practice here at the end of October. So, you know, one, it's really cool because, you know, I'm living in St. Louis now, so it'll be a real like home game as opposed to just one in the States. But yeah, it's all gearing up towards Beijing. I mean, that's the end goal. We're going to be playing in a couple tournaments leading up to there and playing a couple games against Canada, just some exhibition series. But it's going to be a slugfest. I mean, in our group, it's going to be us, Canada, the Russian Paralympic Committee in South Korea, and China has a great team. They're always pushing. It's going to be one of the most competitive Paralympics we've had in recent memory, I think, at least in the sled hockey.
You know, the way you're describing it, I want to watch. You know, one of the things I wanted to end on, Josh, is, and you brought this up earlier, and yeah, I guess this is to the large audience, but to you as well. You know, I never cared where we earned a gold medal. A gold medal to me was a gold medal. And one of the things I've always said is that, yes, there's obviously the USA men's team, which is the top team, right? But I love watching the women win the gold medal. I love watching our inline teams win the gold medal, which they do a lot, right? I love hearing that our sled hockey team has won a gold medal, which they do a lot. You know what I mean? Like I'm just a fan of USA hockey winning gold medals. And I've always looked at it that way. I really have. So my point is to the audience, and you mentioned this, and I do want you to speak to this, is that, don't get me wrong, seeing NHL players in the Olympics and winning a gold medal is special, but that gold medal is worth just as much as your gold medal, right? They are gold medals given out by the International Olympic Committee or the World Championships or whatever, right? So as a, I think you said, but 5, 6, 7, 8-time gold medalist, is that correct count?
I think, yeah, 5 worlds and 3 Paralympics so far.
I do love that we have to think about it. That's how many you've won, right? It's not just off the top of your head, right?
I think I'm just getting old.
Well, okay, that's a compliment, I guess, to us. No, what is that? What, tell me about the gold medal experience. And again, we're taught as journalists never to ask, how does it feel? So I'm not really asking that. I'm saying is you have won several gold medals across the world. What does that represent to you as part of USA Hockey, as an American, as a hockey player in general?
I mean, it's a lot. I mean, I think after the first one, the taste is kind of in your mouth and you want to keep going and want to keep going. I will say there's no better motivator than a loss though. I'm not saying I like winning silver because you don't win silver, you lose the gold. But I think it just keeps you going. It keeps you motivated. And I will say the best part about winning a gold medal is giving it away to the people that helped you get there. You know, my first one, handed to my dad and I said, hey, thanks for driving me to practice. Second one, I was like, hey mom, thanks for helping me out. But my last one, it was giving it to my now wife saying, hey, like, thank you for enduring all me being gone and all the other extracurriculars that she might have to deal with so that I'm able to go play a game I love. It's those things that, you know, you love watching kids, you know, they get scared to touch it because they have that Stanley Cup superstition where they don't want to touch it because they want to win it. Like, it's just such a cool feeling to be able to bring them around. And to be honest, they're really heavy. I don't really like carrying them around and bringing them and stuff. It's kind of a hassle. But I really understand like what kind of impact it can have. I mean, I think one thing, after 2010, I ended up bringing back my gold medal to my local Woodbridge Warriors team. And a kid named Jack Walsh was there. He got to see it. And he told me, he was like, yeah, like that really made me want to like get good and be on the team and play. And in 2017, he made the team. And in 2018, we're hugging it out in the pile, winning a gold medal together. I mean, it was just, it's those moments that you kind of live for, because it's just, I really wish I could give you a better answer. As a motivational speaker, I probably should be able to articulate it.
I think you're giving a great answer, man. I really do. Yeah.
But it's those moments that you live for. It's those are way more important than the gold medal. Those are reasons. Those are things I think of whenever I touch it. I don't think of, oh, I scored this many goals this tournament or this many, right? Probably because I'm not a goal scorer in Paralympics at least. But it's those memories that I know even, you know, 15, 20 years down the line, I'll be able to tell my kids about.
I think that's a phenomenal answer. And I'll tell you this, Josh, as a writer and a speaker myself, I think if you could describe it, it wouldn't be as special as it is, right? There's that great NHL commercial about the Stanley Cup where it's like, it's all the guys winning it, but they're speechless and they can't say anything. And like that, that's what it does to you, right? There's nothing that can be said. I think you did a really great job there. Well, as we said, Beijing's on the horizon. You got to keep winning. Tom Brady's coming after you, man. He doesn't have as many gold medals or championships as you. All right. I want that to be said.
I mean, for right now, I wouldn't count him out.
I would either. Yeah. You can never count him out till he retires, which will happen sometime after his 55th birthday, the rate he is going. But Josh, listen, you're a true champion. You're a tremendous leader for our country and for our hockey team. It really is our privilege and honor to have you on the show today as a leader on the ice, off the ice. And I love that you're dedicating your life to really influencing others in a positive and an inspirational way. We need leaders right now in this country in every facet, and it's been that way for a while. Right. And you, sir, are a true leader, and I appreciate you.
Right. How do people get a hold of you? Because you are so inspirational. And I think if people listen to this podcast, they're probably going to want to know, I need him to speak to our group, our organization. How do we get a hold of you?
So if you go to joshpauls.com, pretty easy, but you can also email me. It's even easier, josh@joshpauls.com. So I do talks. I'm willing to do over Zoom or in person, all depending on, you know, competition schedule. I also have a book I wrote titled Lessons Learned: My Journey to the Podium. I'll make sure I get you guys the link to it, so we can, you guys can Please. Share it and put it yeah. wherever you guys share it.
It'll accompany the episode.
But it kind of, yeah. for sure, no, that'd be great, because it kind of takes through my life journey, my hockey journey, and kind of the lessons I pulled kind of from each year. So it kind of gives you the good, the bad, the ugly, the not so great, but also, you know, just the fun parts of being a Paralympic athlete.
Well,
beautiful.
Yeah. And I think that's awesome. I'd love to read that too, because, you know, everything is about being a human highlight reel right now. We don't talk enough about the bad. We don't talk enough about the things that teach you how to win. Right. So Mike, you have anything else, bud, before we close it out?
No, Josh, thanks for just inspiring us today. And obviously, you know, your dedication to the country, you know, and representing, you know, USA Hockey and the Paralympics. I think it's great. I'm going to really look forward to seeing your book and watching you guys, you know, fight for gold again. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, everybody. It was a pleasure.
It was our pleasure. And that's going to do it for this edition of Our Kids Play Hockey. You can check out this episode and all of them at OurKidsPlayHockey.com. Also, make sure to check us out on Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon, wherever podcasts can be heard, or you can watch them on Facebook and YouTube. Tell your friends about it. Subscribe to it. Have I pitched this enough yet? People, thank you so much for your support. Thank you for this episode. Christy Cash, Andrew Burns, Mike Minnelli, and Josh Pauls. I'm Lee Elias. We'll see you next time on Our Kids Play Hockey. Have a great one.